The content of this program is intended for people who are print and visually impaired. Hello, my name is Joe Austin, and I'm your host and producer for today's episode of Legal Matters, an original program produced in the North Carolina Reading Service studio. For the next half hour, we'll be exploring topics to champion your legal rights to obtain equal access and full participation in to achieve your goals of independent living. Every fourth Tuesday of each month, you can find us here providing news and information from federal and state agencies as well as nonprofit organizations that promote information on law supporting independent living. Legal Matters is underwritten by the law firm of Narin Wenzel, which has offices in Raleigh and in Smithfield. In today's episode, I'm going to be my own guest. And the holidays gave me an opportunity for some reflection and try to think about what the ethos of Legal Matters is. And after 3 years, I thought it was high time for me to come up with an ethos. And I think I could put it in the form of a legal maxim. In Latin, it's lex non favit delicatorum votis. And I'm not sure what the actual context of that was jurisprudentially back in the days of Blackstone. But the translation is the law does not favor the wishes of the dainty. And I think that is what legal remedies are all about these days, that you cannot sit on your rights. You have to go out and perfect them yourself in many instances. And so I was thinking about that and doing some research, and I came across an essay, and it was published in the Atlantic Monthly in 1911 by a writer by the name of Randolph Bourne. And the name of the article at the time was The Handicapped by One of Them. And Mr. Bourne was a writer. He was a magazine writer. And his head was misshapen due to an accident at birth. And then in his early years, he caught tuberculosis of the spine, which stunted his growth. And so he was a short guy with a slightly deformed head. And by pluck and by determination, he made something out of himself. Unfortunately, he died young in 1919 due to the flu epidemic. But he left us with this this essay on the handicapped. And since this is a reading service and it's the new year, I thought it might be appropriate to read this or excerpts from it and see if we can get something out of this and help us with this this ethos that we're trying to develop with Legal Matters. So here goes. Helplessness can make a person content to rest and not to strive. I know a young man so helplessly deformed that he has to be carried about, but he's happy reading a little, playing chess, taking a course or two in college, and all with the sunniest goodwill in the world, and a happiness that seems strange and unaccountable to my restlessness. He does not cry for the moon. When one, however, is in full possession of his faculties and can move about freely, bearing simply a crooked back and an unsightly face, he is perforce drawn into all the currents of life, particularly if he has his own way in the world to make. His road is apt to be hard and rugged, and he will penetrate to an unusual depth in his interpretation both of the world's attitude toward such misfortunes and the attitude toward the world which misfortunes tend to cultivate in men like him. For he has all the battles of the stronger man to fight, and he is at a double disadvantage in fighting them. He has constantly with him the sense of being obliged to make extra efforts to overcome the bad impression of his physical defects, and he's haunted with a constant feeling of weakness and low vitality, which makes effort more difficult and renders him easily faint-hearted and discouraged by failure. He is never confident of himself because he has grown up in an atmosphere where nobody has been very confident of him. And yet his environment and circumstances call out all sorts of ambitions and energies in him, which, from the nature of his case, are bound to be immediately thwarted. This attitude is likely to keep him at a generally low level of accomplishment unless he has an unusually strong will, and a strong will is perhaps the last thing to develop under such circumstances. That vague sense of physical uncomfortableness, which is with him nearly every minute of his waking day, serves, too, to make steady application for hours to any particular kind of work which more irksome than it is even to the lazy man. No one but the deformed man can realize just what the mere fact of sitting a foot lower than the normal means in discomfort and annoyance. For one cannot carry one's special chair everywhere, to theater, library, train, and schoolroom. This sounds trivial, I know, but I mention it because it furnishes a real, even though usually dim, background of consciousness which one has to reckon with during all one's solid work or enjoyment. The things that the world deems hardest for the deformed man to bear are perhaps really the easiest of all. I can truthfully say, for instance, that I have never suffered so much as a pang from the interested comments on my personal appearance made by urchins in the street, nor from the curious looks of people in the street and public places. To ignore this vulgar curiosity is the simplest and easiest thing in the world. It does not worry me in the least to appear on a platform if I have anything to say and there is anybody to listen. What one does get sensitive to is rather the inevitable way that people, acquaintances, and strangers alike have of discounting in advance what one does or says. The deformed man is always conscious that the world does not expect very much from him, and it takes him a long time to see in this a challenge instead of a firm pressing down to a low level of accomplishment. As a result, he does not expect very much of himself. He is timid in approaching people and distrustful of his ability to persuade and convince. He becomes extraordinarily sensitive to other people's first impressions of him. Those who are to be his friends, he knows instantly. And further acquaintance adds little to the intimacy and warm friendship that he at once feels for them. On the other hand, those who do not respond to him immediately cannot, by any effort, either on his part or theirs, overcome the first alienation. This sensitiveness has both its good and bad sides. It makes friendship the most precious thing in the world to him, and finds that he arrives at a much richer and wider intimacy with his friends than do ordinary men with their light surface friendships based on good fellowship or the convenience of the moment. But on the other hand, this sensitiveness absolutely unfits him for business and the practice of a profession where one must be all things to all men, and the professional manner is indispensable to success. For here, where he has to meet a constant stream of men of all sorts and conditions, his sensitiveness to these first impressions will make his case hopeless, except with those few who by some secret sympathy will seem to respond. His deformity will stand like a huge barrier between his personality and other men's. The magical good fortune of attractive personal appearance makes its way almost without effort in the world, breaking down all sorts of walls of disapproval and lack of interest. Even the homely person can attract by personal charm, but deformity cannot even be charming. The doors of the deformed man are always locked, and the key is on the outside. He may have treasures of charm inside, but they will never be revealed unless the person outside cooperates with him in unlocking the door. A friend becomes, to a much greater degree than with the ordinary man, the indispensable means of discovering one's own personality. One only exists, so to speak, with friends. It is easy to see how hopelessly such a sensitiveness incapacitates a man for business, professional, or social life, where the hasty and superficial impression is everything, and disaster is the fate of the man who has not all the treasures of his personality in the front window, where they can be readily inspected and appraised. It thus takes the deformed man a long time to get adjusted to this world. Childhood is perhaps the hardest time of all. As a child, he is a strange creature in a strange land. It was my own fate to be just strong enough to play about with the other boys and attempt all their games and stunts without being strong enough actually to live up to the goals of the game. As I look back now, it seems perfectly natural that I should have followed the standards of the crowd and loathed the high marks I was still able to get in lessons and in deportment, and the concerts to which I was sent by my aunt, and the exhibitions of the musical skill that I developed that I had to give before admiring ladies. Whether or not such an experience is typical of handicapped children, there is tragedy there for those situated as I was. For had I been a little weaker physically, I should have been thrown back on reading omnivorously and cultivating my musical talents, with some possible results. Well, if I had been made a little stronger, I could have participated in the play on an equal footing with the rest. As it was, I was simply tantalized myself and grew up with a deepening sense of failure and a lack of pride in what I really excelled at. When the world became one of dances and parties and social evenings and boy and girl attachments, the world of youth, I was to find myself still less adapted to it, and this was the harder to bear, because I was naturally sociable, and all these things appealed to me tremendously. This world of admiration and gaiety and smiles and favors and quick interest and companionship, however, is only for the well-begotten and the debonair. It took me a long time to understand this, and I continued to attribute my failure mostly to my own character, trying hard to compensate for my physical deficiencies by skill and cleverness. I suffered comparatively few pangs and got much better adjusted to the world than to the other, for I was older and I had acquired a lively interest in all the social politics. I would get so interested in watching how people behaved and in sizing them up that only at rare intervals would I remember that I was really having no hand in the game. This interest just in the ways people are human has become more and more a positive advantage in my life, and has kept sweet many a situation that might easily have cost me a pang. Not that a person with my disabilities should be a sort of detective, using his social opportunities for spying out and analyzing his friend's foibles, but that if he does acquire an interest in people, quite apart from their relation to him, he may go into a society with an easy conscience and a certainty that he will be entertained and possibly entertaining, even though he cuts a poor enough social figure. He must simply not expect too much. Perhaps the bitterest struggles of the handicapped man comes when he tackles the business world. If he has to go out for himself to look for work without fortune, training, or influence, as I personally did, his way will indeed be rugged. His disability will work against him for any position where he must be much in the eyes of men, and his general insignificance has a subtle influence in convincing those to whom he applies that he is unfitted for any kind of work. As I have suggested, his keen sensitiveness to other people's impressions of him makes him more than unusually timid and unable to counteract that fatal first impression by any display of personal force and will. He cannot get his personality over across that barrier. The cards seem stacked against him from the start. With training and influence, something might be done, but alone and unaided, his case is almost hopeless. At least this was my experience. It would be futile to account the story of my struggles. how I besieged for nearly 2 years, firm after firm, in search of a permanent position, trying everything in New York in which I thought I had the slightest chance of success, meanwhile making a precarious living by a few music lessons. The attitude toward me ranged from, "You can't expect us to create a place for you," to, "How could it enter your head that we should find any use for a man like you?" My situation was doubtless unusual. Few men, handicapped as I would be likely to go so long without arousing some interest and supportive in relative or friend. But my experience serves to illustrate the peculiar difficulties that a handicapped man meets if he has his own way to make in the world. He is discounted at the start. It is not business to make allowances for anybody. And while people were not cruel or unkind, it was the hopeless finality of the thing that filled one's heart with despair. The environment of a big city is perhaps the worst possible that a man in such a situation could have, for the thousands of seeming opportunities lead one restlessly on and on and keep one's mind perpetually unsettled and depressed. There is a poignant mental torture that comes with such an experience. The urgent need, the repeated failure, or rather the repeated failure even to obtain a chance to fail, the realization that those at home can ill afford to have you idle, and the growing dread of encountering people. All this is something that those who have never been through it can never realize. Personally, I know of no particular way of escape. One can expect to have never been through it, can never realize. One can expect to do little by one's own unaided efforts. I solved my difficulties only by evading them, by throwing overboard some of my responsibility and taking the desperate step of entering college on a scholarship. Desultory work is not nearly so humiliating when one is using one's time to some advantage, and college furnishes an ideal environment where the things at which a man handicapped like myself can succeed. One's self-respect can begin to grow like a weed. For at the bottom of all the difficulties of a man like me is really the fact that his self-respect is so slow in growing up. So accustomed from childhood to being discounted, his self-respect is not naturally very strong, and will require pretty constant success in a congenial line of work really to confirm it. If he could only more easily separate the factors that are due to his physical disability from those that are due to his weak will and character, he might more quickly attain self-respect, for he would realize what he is responsible for and what he is not. But at the beginning, he rarely makes allowances for himself. He is his own severest judge. He longs for a strong will, and yet the experience of having his efforts promptly nipped off at the beginning is the last thing on earth to produce that will. Life, particularly if he is brought into harsh and direct touch with the real world, is a much more complex thing to him than to the ordinary man. Many of his inherited platitudes vanish at the first touch. Life appears to him as the grim struggle where ability does not necessarily mean opportunity and success, nor piety sympathy, and where helplessness cannot count on assistance and kindly interest. Human affairs seem to be running on a wholly irrational plan, and success to be founded on chance as much as on anything. But if he can stand the first shock of disillusionment, he may find himself enormously interested in discovering how they actually do run, and he will want to burrow into the motives of men and find the reasons for the crass inequalities and injustices of the world he sees around him. He has practically to construct anew a world of his own and explain a great many things to himself that the ordinary person never dreams of finding intelligible at all. He will be filled with a profound sympathy for all who are despised and ignored in the world. when he has been through the neglect and struggles of a handicapped and ill-favored man himself, he will begin to understand the feelings of all the horde of the unpresentable and the unemployable, the incompetent and the ugly, the queer and crotchety people who make up such a large proportion of human folk. We are perhaps too prone to get our ideas and standards of worth from the successful, without reflecting that the interpretations of life which patriotic legend, copybook philosophy, and the sayings of the wealthy give us are pitifully inadequate for those who fall behind in the race. Surely there are enough people to whom the task of making a decent living and maintaining themselves and their families and their social class, or of winning and keeping the respect of their fellows, is a hard and bitter task. To make a philosophy gained through personal disability and failure as just and true a method of appraising the life around us as the cheap optimism of the ordinary professional man, and certainly a kindlier, for it has no shade of contempt or disparagement about it. Often I have tried in arguments to show my friends how much of circumstance and chance go to the making of success. And when I reached the age of sober reading, a long series of the works of social philosophers provided me with the materials of a philosophy which explained why men were miserable and overworked and why there was, on the whole, so little joy and gladness among us, and which fixed the blame. Here was suggested a goal and definite glorious future toward which all men might work. My own working hours became filled with visions of how men could be brought to see all that this meant, and how in particular might work some great and wonderful thing for human betterment. In more recent years, the study of history and social psychology and ethics has made those crude outlines sounder and more normal, and brought them into a saner relation to other aspects of life and thought. But I have not lost the first glow of enthusiasm, nor my belief in social progress as the first right and permanent interest for every thinking and true-hearted man or woman. I am ashamed that my experience has given me so little chance to count in any way toward either the spreading of such a philosophy or toward direct influence and action. Nor do I yet see clearly how I shall be able to count effectually toward this ideal. Of one thing I am sure, however, that life will have little meaning for me except as I am able to contribute toward some such ideal of social betterment, if not in deed, then in word. For this is the faith that I believe we need today, all of us, a belief in human progress, a thorough social consciousness, an eager delight in every sign and promise of social improvement, and best of all, a new spirit of courage that will dare. I want to give to the young men whom I see, who with fine intellect and high principles lack just that light of the future on their faces that would give them a purpose and meaning in life. To them, I want to give some touch of this philosophy that will energize their lives and save them from the disheartening effects of that poisonous counsel of timidity and distrust of human ideals which pours out in steady stream from reactionary press and pulpit. It is hard to tell just how much of this philosophy has been due to my handicaps. If it is solely to my physical misfortunes that I owe its existence, the price has not been a heavy one to pay, for it has given me something that I should not know how to be without. For however gained, this philosophy has not only made the world intelligible and dynamic to me, but has furnished me with the strongest spiritual support. The world has righted itself, and I have been able to appreciate and realize how people count in a social and group capacity as well as in an individual and personal one, and to separate the two in my thinking. Really, to believe in human nature while striving to know the thousand forces that warp it from its ideal development, to call for and expect much from men and women, and not to be disappointed and embittered if they fall short. To try to do good with people rather than to them. This, then, is the goal, the bringing a fuller, richer life to more people on the earth. All institutions and all works that do not have this for their object are useless and pernicious. And this is not to be a mere philosophic precept, which may well be buried under a host of more immediate matters, but a living faith to permeate one's thought and transfuse one's life. Prevention must be the method against evil. To remove temptation from men and to apply the stimulus which shall call forth their highest endeavors. These seem to me to be the only right principles of ethical endeavor. Not to keep waging the age-long battle with sin and poverty, but to make the air around men so pure that foul lungs cannot breathe it. This should be our noblest aim. The difference between what the strongest of the strong and the most winning of the attractive can get out of life and what I can is, after all, so slight. Our experiences and enjoyments, both his and mine, are so infinitesimal compared with the great mass of possibilities, and there must be a division of labor. If he takes the world of physical satisfactions and material success, I at least can occupy the far richer kingdom of mental effort and artistic appreciation. And on the side of what we are to put into life, although I admit that achievement on my part will be harder relatively to encompass than on his, at least I may have the field of artistic creation and intellectual achievement for my own. Indeed, as one gets older, the fact of one's disability fades dimmer and dimmer away from consciousness. One's enemy is now one's own weak will and the struggle to attain the artistic ideal one has set. So to all who are situated as I am, I would say, cultivate the widest interest you can and cherish all your friends. Cultivate some artistic talent, for you will find it the most durable of satisfactions and perhaps one of the surest means of livelihood as well. Achievement is, of course, on the knees of the god, but you will at least have the thrill of trial, and after all, not to try is to fail. And it goes on from there. I've read excerpts from that wonderful essay. You can find it the same way I did. You can Google Randolph Bourne, and it's B-O-U-R-N-E, and read the whole essay, and it's well. It will repay the investment of time. So that is our ethos, to strive, to seek, and not to yield. So that's our New Year's resolution. We've run out of time for today's episode of Legal Matters. Please be sure to tune in next time on the fourth Tuesday of every month at 2 p.m., we rebroadcast on Wednesday at 7 a.m. We hope you've enjoyed the show and discovered information about your legal rights for obtaining equal access and full participation in our community. I'm Joe Austin, your host and producer for the North Carolina Reading Service. And the content of this program is intended for people who are print and visually impaired. After it's broadcast, you can readily find it as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org, where you can listen to it again and share it with others. If you have any comments or questions from today's episode or wish to share a topic that you want us to explore, please call us at 919-832-5138. You can also reach us via email at info@ncreadingservice.org. We look forward to hearing from you. Until next month. Thank you.